From Share Cancer Support, this is RNBC Life, a podcast dedicated to exploring life with metastatic breast cancer from the perspective of us, the people living with this disease, and the experts who partner with us to help make our lives better. I'm Lisa Laudico. Welcome, and so glad you're here, since no one should face NBC alone. Today, we have a conversation hosted by Natalia Green with the co-founders of GRASP, Christine Hodgson and Julia Mowis. The RNBC Life podcast is run by a team of amazing people who, over the course of the last 5 months, have helped me create this forum for initiatives, stories, and research that impact the lives of people living with this disease. This is our second-to-last episode for this inaugural season, and we are grateful to all of our listeners for helping make our little podcast even better. My heart is bursting with gratitude for each and every one of the RNBC Life team. We all roll up our sleeves, learn new tricks, and leap out of our comfort zones to put this out to all of you each week. One such team member, Victoria Goldberg, started with the podcast as one of our rainmaking, cheerleading producers, but she did not stop there. She saw that we needed some help to generate graphics for our social media posts, and so she learned some graphics. Victoria saw that editing of each podcast each week was a huge task, and so she taught herself how to help in that arena too. This is the first podcast edited fully by Victoria, but it won't be the last. She is also trying her hand at hosting, protesting that she didn't like her voice, to which I said, nonsense. Victoria is a big part of what makes the RNBC Life podcast team so special. Lots of heart, willingness to do whatever it takes, and a passion for helping others who face what we face each day. Now here's Victoria introducing today's inspiring guests and true groundbreaking leaders in the NBC community.
Christine Hodgson was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer in 2015. She brings a background in biology and nonprofit programming to her work of curating cutting-edge research and interfacing with patients and research partners. She had worked with leading research organizations, medical centers, and government agencies to ensure that the patient's voice is represented early and often. She is also the founder of the Storm Riders Network, a website that shares the latest breast cancer research, treatments, and the clinical trials. Julia Mowis was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2013 while pregnant. Following the birth of a healthy baby boy, she did some tests that she couldn't do while pregnant and discovered that her cancer had spread to the brain, liver, and bones. After many treatment setbacks, her cancer began to respond to treatment. Cancer is part of Julia's life, but it does not define her. Her goal is to make an impact in the lives of others living with this disease. She has found meaning and purpose in working with patients and researchers to make cancer research more patient-centered, innovative, and inclusive. And now our co-host Natalia Green begins her interview with Christine and Julia.
We're so glad to have you on our NBC Life. GRASP, which stands for Guiding Researchers and Advocates to Scientific Partnership, we started last year at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, and it's already made a tremendous impact in the NBC research and advocate communities. Tell us what inspired you both to create this organization.
Yeah, so I think it's actually very organic how it happened. And I think good ideas are the ones that are effortless. And it wasn't really that hard to pull together. And it sort of fell into our laps more than we created it our own. We actually just reacted. So what happened was I was just walking through a poster session at ASCO by myself. And I was approached by Corey Painter, who is a cancer researcher and director of the Count Me In Initiative, which also has the NBC project. And she's very patient focused. She's a cancer survivor herself. And she's just a wonderful teacher. And she said, can I tag along with you as you walk through the posters, and I was thrilled. I was like, oh yeah, I'll have a researcher walk with me. And we just found that we were both learning a lot from each other, that I was able to offer a patient perspective and she was able to maybe break down science that I was having trouble understanding or a graph that I didn't really know how to interpret. And this is cool. And nobody's really leading poster walkthroughs. It's a wash for everybody involved. Authors are standing by their posters, hoping somebody might come by and talk to them. And patient advocates are definitely overwhelmed because there's so many posters and they don't know where to start. And we've heard people say that they're just intimidated and they don't want to bother people. They feel like if they go up and talk to them, they're bothering them. So we just knew that there was a need here, and we tweeted about it. That's when I employed Julia because she's the Twitter master. And I said, can you please help me craft a tweet to explain what this is and how we think it's a cool idea, and let's see what the response is. And we got a fantastic response, people asking how they can sign up for the program, which of course did not exist. And so we worked all summer with Corey and a few other trusted advisors, and we created a program that we ended up piloting at San Antonio. And so to answer the question, I think we just felt that there, it's important that advocates are involved in the research process, but there's not really any opportunities for advocates and researchers to meet. There are a few select programs. You have to apply for them. You maybe have to be able to take off time from work and go travel, when we used to travel pre-corona, to attend these types of trainings that involve researchers and advocates. So we were trying to find something that was more accessible and allowed more people to participate and more people to be exposed, not only to the patients to be exposed to the researchers, but the researchers to have exposure to patients and to learn things from the patient perspective. So that was how it started, and we piloted at San Antonio, and it was wildly successful, and we're going to be there again this year. Julia, did you want to add anything else that I forgot?
No, I think this is it. The idea is that we highlight the experience of a patient as an expertise, just like a clinician is an expert in treating the patients with cancer. A scientist is an expert in the science of cancer. The patients are the experts in living with cancer, and we all have to come together and talk to each other, exchange ideas, talk about how it's possible to move forward to make breakthroughs that are actually meaningful. And this connection is not an easy one to make. Sometimes we joke, like, a scientist can't come to the infusion clinic and say, hey, I am working on a preclinical model with mice that is looking at your subtype of cancer. Can I ask you a few questions of how it feels to be sitting here getting this infusion, right? You can't have these connections happen that way. And you end up having a few patients who go to conferences and who have these connections being the ones that the scientists are always coming back to and talking to. And we want to make this something that all patients have the ability to do. I personally am not religious, so my hope comes in the form of science. I want to hear the latest discoveries, and that is where my hope comes, to be alive for longer so I can see my son grow up.
That's really fantastic. And as a patient too, it is overwhelming to feel like you can be an expert at this disease, or as a patient yourself. And I feel like a lot of control is lost when you're not advocating for yourself, or you're not more aware of research or the medical possibilities that are out there. So this is really fantastic. What do you think makes GRASP different from other initiatives that are out there right now for patient advocacy?
Yeah, I think the difference is recognizing patients as the experts. Like Julia said, a lot of programs, but I'm not putting them down because they're very useful. Scientists have a lot to teach us, but it's often the scientist is on the pedestal and everybody else is there to listen and learn. And so what we wanted to do is level that playing field, bring them off their pedestal. We're all on an equal playing field, and help them understand that we, like Julia said, we're experts in living with this disease. They're experts in treating it, but we're experts in living it. Or maybe they're experts in studying it. But ultimately, we're the end user of this research. And so we should be consulted. We should be involved. And we think that we can drive better research by our involvement being early and often. And so I think that is the unique difference. We're also looking to actually create meaningful relationships and collaborations. When you do, for example, a webinar where you have one person talking and 20 people listening, you really significantly decrease the chances of actually establishing a meaningful connection with either the advocates or with the scientists. So what we wanted to do, and I've said this before, people don't believe me, but I do have an introverted personality, and having these small breakout sessions. So let me back up a little bit, because it is different now from San Antonio when we did it was pre-corona and we were in person. And so what we did is we all met as they had small groups and they would travel to different posters that they were assigned to that morning. Now we do everything virtually. So we start off with a big Zoom meeting and then they get assigned into breakout groups. So it's still small groups of no more than five people, like maybe two advocates, a mentor who's also a patient advocate that's experienced and taking the lead and guiding the discussion. And then we have the scientist who is there to interpret the science and help us understand it. So those are how the groups are set up. And that is all in itself already unique. And we've had to fight against a lot of people want us to record the GRASP sessions. A lot of people want us to allow more people into the GRASP session. And basically, we have to push back and say that compromises our model. That's not the model of GRASP. The model is that we want small, intimate sessions so that people can feel comfortable and feel confident asking questions. And we don't want one person dominating the discussion. And that's the mentor's role, is to make sure that not one person is taking over, including the scientists. They get to stop a scientist and say, hey, we need you to slow down. Let's ask the patients for their opinion on this. So that I think that is how it is unique from others.
Yeah, it's definitely multi-directional. So it's not just the scientist speaking to the audience. You have the audience participating in a conversation. We call it sometimes a conversation, an exchange of ideas, or where you're pushing each other. But why? But how did you do that? But why did you think that mattered? But are those people going to have to go in every day, or taking the idea further by having the people ultimately impacted participating in the discussion? And like Christine said, in conferences, you have the speaker stand on a podium with a microphone. And our first session in San Antonio was at the poster session, which some of the listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with. But for those who aren't, science conferences have big halls that are taken over by boards, and scientists pin their posters, large posters with their science idea and experiment and conclusions. And people walk around those large halls discussing all of those projects. And the poster session allowed us to bring small groups of people walking around together. There's no stage. Everyone's walking on the same floor. People are not in their white coats. So you can actually not even differentiate who's an advocate, who's a doctor, who's a scientist. We're all human, and we're all looking to advance the same goal, which is improve the care for people living with cancer and ultimately lengthen their lives and make them live better lives. And together, by talking and exchanging these opinions and ideas, is how we can make all of that research better.
That's fantastic. I love this idea, even the image of creating an equitable table where we're all standing at the same level. There's no one's higher than the other person. That's really fantastic, because it can be, really speaking for myself, it can be very intimidating trying to talk to an expert about something. So you don't want to sound too dumb. You don't want to sound misinformed. And maybe you don't even know what you're talking about or really understand in general. So that's really great.
I was just going to add one thing too, which is that a lot of people think they have to have a science background to actually get something out of these poster sessions. And I have a lot of people say, oh, I can't participate in GRASP. I don't know anything about the science. And I'm like, no, that's exactly who the program is for. It's for people who have an interest in learning a little bit more about their disease, maybe. It can help inform your decisions and treatment plan and things like that. You don't have to have a science background. And in fact, we had so many people walking away from the San Antonio, the first pilot program that we launched at San Antonio, saying, oh my God, I love science. I understand it. And it really just takes a good teacher sometimes to help you understand it. And so we're very careful with who we select for our scientists. And we make sure that we have excellent mentors as well that can help guide that discussion and make sure that the science is being explained.
Now, I understand that GRASP has at least three main areas of focus. You do the poster walkthroughs, the virtual exchanges, and the GRASP registry. Let's go back and talk about the poster walkthroughs. I know we talked about it a little bit just now, but some of our listeners might not be familiar with what happens at the San Antonio or the ACC, or the American Society of Clinical Oncology. describe what those types of oncology conferences were like before you guys created GRASP.
Well, a lot of conferences are still just the same way, but it's usually a really large venue, a big room with tall ceilings. And sometimes I think at ASCO, they have, I don't know how many posters, but it's definitely in the hundreds of posters. And it's people milling around, and what you're doing is you're scanning. You get the poster titles ahead of time. Sometimes you can get the abstracts ahead of time, so you know which posters are going to be there. If you're somebody who wants to scour all the posters that are available, they'll usually post them on the website. But then you have to find the poster, you have to go look, and then sometimes the author is not there. So sometimes you're just looking and scanning this poster. And I should explain, a scientific poster is just taking the scientific method and putting it on paper. So it's going through like a study. So it might have the highlights at the top, and then it'll explain the methods, the goal of the study, how the study was designed, the results of the study, and then the primary conclusions. So some of these posters can look extremely intense, a lot of details, a lot of graphs, a lot of pictures sometimes. And so it's really hard to parse out what's important. If it's done well, a valuable part of learning is actually speaking to the author and asking questions. So that's what the poster, when we talk about a poster walkthrough, most scientific conferences have them. Even when I was a conservation biologist, I actually did a scientific poster at a conference at one point. So I'm familiar with them, but I forget that not everybody knows what that means. And it's just a scientific method, and the whole experiment is basically on a piece of paper, but it's a huge big poster that you have a lot of information on to decipher. So yes.
Can you give examples how virtual exchanges work, especially during these COVID quarantine times? How's that momentum for your research and for announcements and conferences? How has that affected the GRASP organization?
So when we first did GRASP in San Antonio, it was a program where people met in person, shook hands, looked into each other's eyes, had a personal connection, really. So the whole program was around connecting people. And then COVID happened and we couldn't be anywhere in person. So, okay, we're going to have to do something virtually. So we started exploring some technology platforms, and everyone was going to Zoom. And actually, my son was also going to school virtually at the time, and I learned from his teacher about breakout rooms in Zoom. and I was, okay, that actually might work for GRASP, because it is a virtual way to do what we did in San Antonio at the poster session. So basically, we have an overview of welcome. This is what GRASP is about. Here's how we want you to talk to each other. And it's not only the scientist talking. Please let the mentor take the lead in guiding the conversation. It's okay to interrupt each other, pause, go back, all of these things to give an overview of the program. And then at a conference, we would send people off to their walks, right? And go find your posters that you have on a little list and talk about that science. And virtually, we send them off to a breakout room and they go and they talk. It could be, if it's around a virtual conference, they would talk about posters at that virtual conference. But we also realized that we now, because it's virtual, have the ability to do it whenever we want. And science doesn't happen twice a year at ASCO and at San Antonio for breast cancer, right? Those are big events that presentations happen, but science is happening all throughout the year. And we are big advocates for including the patients early and often. So we want to have scientists come talk to patients early in their research when they're just having the idea, or how does it feel when you do this or that? Or what would you take something that you have to this and that? Those conversations need to happen very early. And this provides a platform to have those discussions so a scientist can come to us with an idea and say that they would like to talk to young women with breast cancer in their families about this sort of study. And that would be a way to get together patients and really have a focus group where they would bounce off ideas, hear what they have to say, and really giving us that ability to reach people anytime and anywhere. And we know that the patients, the advocates that are going to these conferences tend to be the same ones that have been going to conferences in the past. And they also tend to be a certain demographic. They're white, they're wealthier, more educated, they're older because they don't have families and jobs. And just doing things virtually allows us to reach all the people that we wouldn't reach. So yes, absolutely. These things are very important to us. Fantastic. Everything we do with GRASP, we really think carefully about how to be more inclusive and do better.
Awesome. Now, how does the registry work?
Yeah, we're just getting started with that. We have a registry. We have a database, basically. We're collecting information. So I can right now just plug going to our website. It's graspcancer.org. And there's a tab at the top that says join us. And when you do that, you get to click whether you're a scientist, whether you're an advocate. And we ask different questions about your subtype, if you were a survivor, if you're a researcher, what you study, what your research interests are. And we're collecting that data. And we're essentially going to create a registry that will allow people to find researchers if they're interested. A lot of people, for example, if you have lobular breast cancer or inflammatory breast cancer, where there's sometimes a lack of research, people want to find researchers who are studying their subtype of cancer. We would have this registry that we can allow patients to find researchers. But I think more use and the biggest utility we're going to get out of this registry are researchers finding advocates. This didn't happen to me at the beginning. It happened to me as I became more involved in advocacy. I would get asked to write a letter of support for a grant. And I was usually asked last minute after the study was already designed and it was due in like a day or two. So that's what we're really trying to get away from. We want to establish relationships from the beginning so that as the trial is being designed, we get to have input in that design. But I would even argue that we'd like to go further back and ask the question of why are you doing this research? How is it actually going to help me? So the registry would allow, we get a lot of requests, Julie and I do, about, do you have a stage four patient? I need a Black woman who's stage four, who's from the South. And so Julie and I, we know people on social media, but obviously we don't know everybody. And so we just wanted to create a tool that both scientists and advocates can use to find each other. So we're in the process of developing that. And you can help us do that by, you know, joining, because then we can collect that information. And when you do that, you'll be on a listserv, which you can always opt out of, but we'll give you opportunities to participate in future GRASPs, whether it's at a conference or at an e-GRASP, like what Julie was talking about, where it's not associated with and not affiliated with a conference, but it might just be over a topic that people are interested in. We just did one on the SEER database. So that was initiated by advocates on Twitter. And so we encourage people to tell us if you want to contact us. You can contact us at hello@graspcancer.org. If you have an idea, we are always happy to entertain ideas. So advocates can do that and researchers can as well. If they have a study or a grant that they would like some feedback on, we encourage both to do that.
I love that. When I first got diagnosed, it was so overwhelming to try to find trials and to see where you fit and all those things. Like, it's a deterrent. Like, I'll just trust my doctors, and if something comes up, they'll mention it to me, which they probably won't. But so the fact that you have a registry that someone is trying to find you, that feels really encouraging.
Let's take a quick break. Do you remember what it was like when you were first diagnosed with MBC? Of course you do. Or when you had progression. Or maybe that time when you really, really needed to talk to someone about a new treatment or new side effects. Well, the trained volunteers at the SHARES TalkMeds helpline understand what you're going through and are ready to speak with anyone living with MBC on these and other topics. Today, we are recruiting people just like you to join us. If you enjoy talking to people and helping others, and if you have a few hours a week to volunteer, TalkMeds is the right place for you. Contact me, Victoria Goldberg, at vgoldberg@sharecancersupport.org. Or if you need more information, go to our website, sharecancersupport.org. Our volunteers are all given training and are supported by the SHARES Cancer Program. Every TalkMeds volunteer truly makes a difference in the lives of people living with MBC. Join us. We would love to have you, since no one should face MBC alone. Let's get back to co-host Natalia Green's interview with the co-founders of GRASP, Christine Hodgton and Julia Maus.
Hi. You want me to take this one, Julia, or do you want to take it? She's shaking her head.
You can take it, and I'll say something later.
So it's new, what's exciting and new for MBC Research? Was that the question? Just making
yes.
sure I understood it.
Is there something that's exciting that you're finding that's happening in?
I do a lot of work with the MBC Alliance as well. And so I am spearheading an initiative to address the unmet research needs for breast cancer patients with brain metastasis. It was actually very disheartening when I was doing research on this because I realized that there was so much we didn't know. But the more I learn, I think that there are actually really amazing treatment options out there, but they're not being studied because brain mets has often been excluded from trials, and it's even worse for patients with leptomeningeal disease. So I'm finding that these antibody drug conjugates we've had several approvals just this year, and one of the first for triple negative breast cancer. So there is some evidence that ADCs, antibody drug conjugates, can cross the blood-brain barrier, and Julie is actually a perfect example. She's been on Kadcyla for something like 6 years, a little over 6 years. And
wow.
She had extensive brain mets at the beginning, and now she's NED and stable. Sorry, Julia, for telling your story. But it's just an amazing example of this. And it's anecdotal at this point that ADCs actually do work in the brain. But I'm confident that as we become louder, the advocates become louder in saying, we need to study this. We don't want it just anecdotal evidence. We want concrete data to show that these drugs can cross the blood-brain barrier or that they can be effective in treating brain metastases. And along those same lines, I think liquid biopsies are going to be amazing once they become standard. Brain mets patients often can't get a biopsy. It's dangerous sometimes to get a biopsy for a brain. It'll be very interesting to see if we can start diagnosing cancer just with blood, either getting a blood sample or a sample from your cerebral spinal fluid, which is often how a leptomeningeal diagnosis can come about. So I think liquid biopsy, we've basically been begging for it for a long time now. When is it going to happen? It's done, but I think that it's still kind of early. And so it's not quite as reliable as, say, a tissue sample. You might get more information from a tissue sample. I review a lot of grants, and it's coming. There's a lot out there. So those are my two big ones. Go ahead, Julia, if you want to add another.
So Christine's the trials and drugs nerd. So she gives the overview. When you ask her, what are you excited about when it comes to what's coming up in MBC, she'll give you like specific mutations and drugs. And my answer is broader in the sense that I think they're hearing us. So that's what I'm very hopeful about. I'm hopeful about decisions are starting to not be made without
patients being consulted. So for example, they're not just assuming that patients want oral drugs instead of infusion drugs. They're actually talking to patients and understanding what is the problem with getting drugs and how does that actually impact your insurance copay. And they're getting patients involved in these decisions. And that's what I'm hopeful about. And definitely the whole brain mets discussion is one where patients are actually pushing and starting to make a difference. They're not able to exclude patients with brain mets anymore at the level that they were doing it before, because we are screening and we're calling them out, and it actually looks bad if they disregard the people who are participating in trials, volunteering their time, going through extra tests, going through extra work so that we can advance research.
That is really exciting. And Julia, the fact that you are living with, or in your NED right now, but with brain, it's so encouraging to hear because it's such a scary diagnosis at the beginning. So it actually really touches my heart to know that things are working out well for you.
When I first was diagnosed, my doctor told me about Terlisa Shepherd. And I remember I said, oh, but I bet she doesn't have metastatic cancer. And he's like, yes, she does have metastatic cancer. Oh, but she wasn't pregnant when she was diagnosed. Yes, she was pregnant when she was diagnosed. But it didn't go to her brain because that, I don't know how I'm going to survive. She actually has been living with brain mets at the time for like 12 years or something. It's going to be like 18, I think, that she had brain mets diagnosed, and she's still alive and thriving and changing the world. So I know how impactful it was to hear Terlisa's story and to one day meet her and her daughter who she was pregnant with. So it warms my heart that I'm an image of hope for you, Natalia, that you can see that it is possible. And it's nothing that I did. I was just lucky. I really hope you're lucky too. And it's not like things are done. I still get scans. I had surgery in my brain. I had very complicated times, and things are still always tense and difficult. And I'm no evidence of active disease, but my scans are like 2 pages long, the reports, because there's so many things that they're seeing and mentioning. It seems like everything's okay, but it's still like a level of stress that someone that hasn't lived this would have no idea.
Well, it could change so quickly. We know from our community, right, how quick things can change.
Yeah.
And there's so much focus these days on the power of the patient advocate and what NBC patient advocates have been able to accomplish. Do you see opening a role with GRASS and similar initiatives for caregivers, sometimes called like co-survivors?
It already is open to caregivers. We should have mentioned that. You don't actually have to be a patient to participate. You can be a caregiver. You don't even have to consider yourself an advocate, but most people do. And so we actually ask that when we ask people to sign up, how do you identify? And that will help us if maybe we will have a grasp on caregiving a metastatic cancer patient. And so we would be soliciting caregivers for a grasp like that. And then the same with the researchers and scientists. There actually are a lot of researchers and scientists that have been patients at one time. So we even ask that question too, to find out, did they have a cancer diagnosis at some point? And that's always, we find that those who've been through cancer are the best doctors. They're the ones who know what it's like to be a patient and what you need as a patient from the doctor. So it's just interesting. We get that a lot. They're like, I'm a patient also. I'm both. So we've made sure that the form addresses both of those so that we're getting the full picture. But yes, caregivers absolutely are invited.
That's awesome. And it's nice to have that extra brain with your caregivers to get that information.
Absolutely.
And to help have a sense of control where you're going through this process as well. So in the realm of NBC advocacy, we're always looking for ways for our listeners to be involved in ways that make sense for their lives, their passions, and their talents. What do you both see as good opportunities for advocacy for individuals living with NBC who may not have time because of either their full-time parents, their working, treatment, side effects?
Yeah, so we both are graduates of LBBC's Hear My Voice. I think, Natalia, did you do the Young Advocate or Hear My Voice?
I did the Young Advocacy.
Yeah, it is just such a wonderful organization. And it is a time commitment, especially if you go in person, you go to the conference, you have to arrive a few days early. So that could be tricky for some people. But they do such a wonderful job guiding people through all possible ways that you could go as an advocate. And my mentor at Hear My Voice was Judy Erdahl, and she died last year. And I was in the training when she said something to my class and said, I want you all to remember that whatever you do does not have to be big to be meaningful. So yes, you can start an organization eventually. You can become a co-host on RMBC Live. And these are all different ways to use your experience and transform it into something positive. But there's so many different ways that you could transform into something positive. You can just give your phone number to the social worker and say that a newly diagnosed person in your hospital could contact you. That's an amazing thing to do, knowing how important it is to have someone that can share that they've been there and this is how it happened to me. Or people have done such amazing fundraising and giving money to people that are less fortunate or people that are not able to access insurance in ways that others are. We know that in this country, there's so many inequalities. I think that the right path is to first look at everything that people have been doing and connect with others and really take your time. I didn't do Hear My Voice and didn't start becoming involved in advocacy until 2018. My cancer was diagnosed in 2013. That means that I spent 5 years of my life pretty much without advocacy and with cancer. I mean, I was pregnant. I had a new baby. I had very complicated disease, heart problems, brain mets, surgeries. But eventually, my son was a little older. He started going to school. I had some free time. It was the right time for me, and that's when it should have happened.
I'm glad you mentioned the LBBC. I'm in complete agreement with you. I think their training is probably some of the best training I've ever been through for advocacy work in general. They're just so thorough, and it was just so informative. There is a range of advocacy that fits anyone. So that's fantastic. What are your goals for this year, now that it's virtual for SABCS? What are the goals for 2021?
Oh yeah, we got lots of plans. So we're actually, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, Julia. Am I allowed to say that we're in the process of thinking about becoming a nonprofit?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we're not sure yet how we want to, we just know that we could accomplish a lot more if we were able to raise funds. And the truth is, without even trying, we basically were donated $20,000 last year. And with those funds, we were able to send 12 patient advocates to the San Antonio Breast Cancer Conference, and 11 of them were African-American. So that's keeping in line with our goals to diversify the patients that we bring to these conferences. So, you know, we, after doing that, it was really hard, a lot of travel, a lot of logistics, and I think it took away from what we want to do with the program. So I don't know that we'll be doing travel scholarships again, but we definitely want to expand this to other conferences. And in fact, we would love to go beyond breast cancer. We already have a little bit. ASCO is a conference that covers all types of cancer. So we had 7 different cancer types represented at the GRASP session there. Some of these patients, they don't have any kind of advocate. Breast cancer is just so common, unfortunately, but it's also one of these cancers that has these amazing individuals who know how to organize and create support groups and create. I have a different perspective, as I was a caregiver over 10 years ago now for my father, who died of a rare type of sarcoma, and there was nothing. I never met another rhabdomyosarcoma patient. There was no support. There were no treatments. There were absolutely no trials. And so I always have that. I always have my dad and like his experience weighing on my heart. And I think about all these other cancers that don't have the support or the advocacy that we have. So I would love to bring this to other conferences so that patients can actually feel like they have a voice. So it's just the two of us that are running this right now. And as Julia mentioned, we're both metastatic breast cancer patients. We both have to deal with our own treatments and our own symptoms and side effects. So it's hard to run this on our own, but we're hoping to expand, and we have brought on somebody part-time as well to help us out. So that's her name is Samantha Horn, and she served as a GRASP mentor, and she's actually treated, she's an early stage survivor. She was treated Hopkins, and that's where I'm treated, and that's how we met. And she's going to be a big help to us because we need the whole staff at this point to expand and grow, but we're doing it, and we're trying to do it slowly and in a way that will allow this model to be easily replicated and scaled up at different conferences. I would say that's our big goal for 2021 and beyond. And we'd love to get our registry beefed up a little bit so we have more people in that, so that we can connect more people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we really enjoy having these ideas and talking about how to make the program better. But ultimately, we wouldn't be able to run something like this. We want to get it in the shape where it can run with staff by itself. And both of us, we're not working anymore. We're fully focused on our survivorship. And that's just how things worked out for us. And we left our careers, which were very different. And now advocacy does give us meaning and purpose, but it cannot take over our lives, right?
Yeah, completely agree. But that's really exciting. That sounds really promising. And I think, not that breast cancer, I wouldn't say it's sexy, but people know more about breast cancer than other cancers. And that's great that you're trying to expand to lesser known cancers to connect people together. Julia and Christine, in the past interviews, we've asked all of our guests what you're doing to take care of your own mental health. during these difficult times. Do you have any good tips or anything that you're doing for self-care?
That's a tough question right now because we are reeling from the loss of Shante Randall, who was a host on this podcast and a dear, dear friend. And we've had a very tough week and a half. It's been very rough. Yeah. And we were grateful that her family basically allowed us to say goodbye to her. And that was very important for us. It's very important to be able to say that. And I think that helped both of us. And to be honest, we're talking a lot. One of her best friends is on a group text with us, and we are just constantly exchanging a memory that we had of Shante, or we'll just say, hey, I feel like crap today. I just feel awful and I'm really struggling. Or I had a great day. I saw a ladybug and I think maybe that was Shante. So we're grieving together. We can't really be together, but we're allowed to grieve together in this virtual format. And that's helped. I'm not going to lie. I drink a lot of wine. And I know not everybody can do that because maybe their treatments won't allow that because they'll feel sick. But for me, sometimes I need to numb that pain a little bit. And I just want people to know everything in moderation. It's okay to have a glass of wine. And I try to do yoga in the mornings. And I have this whole self-care routine now because I'm very nervous about the winter. I have that seasonal depression. And you throw Corona on top of that. And I'm like, oh my God. So I do like aromatherapy. I have a light box, which is like a light that you use in the morning to give yourself, I don't know what it is, like vitamin D or something. And it helps sleep better at night. And I try to exercise and I try to get outside for walks and things like that. But it's also totally fine to have a glass of wine and watch Netflix, whatever gets you through. I get frustrated when I hear people like, yes, I do yoga and I do exercise. And it's like, okay, that's fair. And that's great. That's great for people. And I do that too sometimes, but there are times where I just need to veg out. I just need my mind to be blank. So that's how I'm getting through.
Totally agreed. That sounds fantastic. I like your method.
Yeah. The last week has been extra hard with the loss of our dear friend. Before that, in terms of coronavirus in general, so I have a 7-year-old son, and obviously it's affecting kids in a significant way. And one thing that we've done that has really changed our lives, we got 2 kittens. And I had an older cat, and he got really upset that there was a kitten bugging him the whole time. So we eventually decided to get a 2nd kitten. So now I have Mozzarella and Fauci, and they play around all day. And my older cat gets to sleep and be relaxed. But these pets have changed our lives completely.
That's all the questions I have for you, too. It was such a pleasure interviewing you all, and I'm really excited about your organization. I hope this nonprofit comes into fruition, and I'm going to make sure I register myself and keep on tabs and with you all as well.
Yes, please.
This podcast is produced by me, Lisa Laudico, and our truly collaborative and expanding team of Jersey Baker, Natalia Green, Victoria Goldberg, Kirby Lewis, Sheila McGlone, Shante Randall, and Anne Woodward. Our executive producer is Christine Benjamin, the Senior Director of Patient Services and Education at Share Cancer Support. Interning with us are Angelica Alberstadt and Amy Tedeschi. We have benefited from expert social media consulting from Jake Amorelli, and we now have, finally, expert sound design and original music compositions from Jim Clemens. We have an exciting December planned to close out our inaugural season, and we look forward to launching Season 2 in March of 2021. You can find more of our episodes of RNBC Life wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe, rate us, and review us, and look for a new episode every Monday. And submit your Just Gotta Share moments, check out our blog, and full episode notes on our website at rnbclife.org. We'd love to hear from you.